Fear not. To fear anything is to believe that you are separate from God. You and your Father are inseparable. Your greatest challenge in life is to accept this truth and live it every day. Know that love and peace are your birthright. When this thought pattern begins to dominate your consciousness, then and only then are you free to experience total peace, peace that passes all understanding.
Peace that passes all understanding.
These and other concepts are beautifully illustrated and explained in a book entitled The Sermon on the Mount. It continues to be a bestseller since its first publication in 1934, and the author is Dr. Emmett Fox. This tape is designed to introduce Dr. Fox's philosophy of scientific Christianity, as he explained it in The Sermon on the Mount. To those already familiar with the great works of Emmett Fox, this tape will provide another means of enjoying his teachings.
He grew up in England, where his father was a member of parliament as well as a practicing surgeon. As a young boy, Emmett was recognized by his family as one who could cure headaches by the simple touch of his small hand. As he grew up, this seemingly unique ability to heal led him into the study of metaphysics and away from the traditional religion of his parents. Referred to as a scholar, teacher, writer, healer, philosopher, and minister, he was also an electrical engineer until a few years before he came to America in 1930. Dr. Fox's religious teachings were headquartered out of the Church of the Healing Christ at Carnegie Hall in New York City for 20 years. It is estimated that 5,000 people attended his weekly sermons. While on vacation in Paris, France, Emmett Fox died of a stroke on August the 13th, 1950. He was deeply missed by the thousands of people who attended his church and the hundreds of thousands all over the world who followed his beliefs through his books and articles. Let's hear more about the philosophy and teachings contained in The Sermon on the Mount.
The Bible is the most precious possession of the human race. It contains the key to life. It shows us how to live so that we may have health, freedom, and prosperity. It meets everyone on his own level and brings him to God. It has a solution for every problem. It is the greatest literary work ever compiled and by far the most interesting of all books. We will gain even more by reading it with a spiritual key, the key to understanding how to apply the Bible to our daily lives. However, the real value of the Bible lies in the spiritual interpretation. Wonderful as the outer Bible is, it is far less than 1% of the inner Bible, the Bible that is hidden behind the symbols.
The Bible is not primarily intended to teach history or biography or natural science. It is intended to teach psychology and metaphysics. It deals basically with states of mind and the laws of mental activity. Each of the characters in the Bible represent a state of mind that any of us may experience, and the events that happen to the various characters illustrate the consequences of entertaining such states of mind, either good or bad.
Some of the Bible characters, such as Moses, Elijah, and Paul, are historical figures. They were real men who lived on earth and did the deeds attributed to them. But they also represent states of mind at different levels of growth as their lives unfolded. Other Bible characters, such as Adam and Eve, the prodigal son, the Good Samaritan, or the Scarlet Woman, though never having an actual existence, were written to express states of mind, and always in a remarkably simple and graphic manner.
Any text in the Bible can be taken in the past, present, or future, because God is outside of time.
The Bible teaches that outer conditions and events are not important in themselves, but only as far as they necessarily express the character or consciousness of the subject.
The Bible is infinitely optimistic. It doesn't say that everything will be all right. Things will not be right unless we make them so, by right thinking. It teaches that negative thoughts and beliefs, especially the sin of limiting God, can bring all kinds of trouble and suffering. Wrong thinking can only bring wrong results.
Wrong thinking can only bring wrong results.
This is no get-rich-quick scheme. The Bible teaches that if we have faith in God, He will supply our needs bountifully. Naturally, we can't just order up the life we want just by thinking it so, as though God must obey our commands. Simply willing something to be will not make it happen. For example, metaphysics will not bring money for money's sake. Since we can only see the part of life we are living, involving a short time span, our wishes and desires are not always for the best. What the Bible does teach is that our lives turn out as a result of the thoughts we think. If we have an awareness or consciousness of love, health, and prosperity, it will show in our words and deeds and actions.
Mind over matter. The Bible teaches that what we see around us, our life, is merely the results of our own thoughts and beliefs. Therefore, we really can't dominate something outside of our minds, but we can change our minds. The Bible doesn't pretend that our troubles are imaginary. Troubles are there for our experience. But the Bible says that experience can be dissolved by realizing the presence of God.
To realize the presence of God means to affirm God's love. God created the universe. He only creates perfection. Therefore, this too shall pass.
We can raise our thoughts to see a perfect world, a world without the particular problems that we currently face. Overcoming our problems is not accomplished by faith healing in the sense of fighting an alleged evil with blind faith and sheer willpower. The Bible teaches an intelligent and understanding faith based on the goodness and all-presence of God. The truth is that God is the only presence and the only power, that He is entirely good, that evil is a false belief about the truth, and that the outer world is the manifestation or result of our own minds.
The Bible teaches that today's prayer can put everything right, if only we won't look back to yesterday. Remember the story of Lot's wife? She turned into a pillar of salt. Salt is a preservative, and in the Bible this symbolizes the human tendency to hold on to the past and remain chained to old ways of thinking. The Bible teaches us to go forward with new ideas and new aspirations, to new adventures. To quote Dr. Fox,
"The study of the Bible is not unlike the search for diamonds. At first, people found a few diamonds in the yellow clay, and they were delighted with their good fortune, even while they supposed that this was the full extent of their find. Then, upon digging deeper, they came upon the blue clay, and to their amazement, they then found as many precious stones in a day as they had previously found in a year, and what had formerly seemed like wealth faded into insignificance beside the new riches. In your exploration of Bible truth, see to it that you do not rest satisfied in the yellow clay of a few spiritual discoveries, but press on to the rich blue clay underneath. The Bible, however, differs from the diamond field in the sublime fact that beneath the blue clay, there is a richer strata, awaiting the touch of spiritual perception on and on to infinity. As you read the Bible, constantly affirm that divine wisdom is enlightening you. That is the way to get direct inspiration."
There are many other key phrases and rich concepts which form the core to Dr. Fox's philosophy. Scientific prayer, also referred to as spiritual treatment, is really the lifting of your consciousness or awareness above the level where you have faced a problem. Raise your consciousness above the problem and let God do the rest. To raise your consciousness, you must positively withdraw your attention from the problem and concentrate gently upon spiritual truth. This can be done by reading the Bible, going over a hymn or poem, or listening to music that helps you, or by using affirmations. An affirmation is a positive statement or thought, such as, "God is with me," or "God loves me." It's important when using affirmations not to inject any negative energy or feelings. Replace your emotions with positive, loving thoughts. It doesn't matter how you rise above the problem, but you must remove yourself emotionally and experience the peace of God.
True place is a term which means to be with God. To be with God is the ideal place for us all. However, as we are working towards reaching that level, wherever we find ourselves today is our right place. Where we are at any given time, no matter how confused or lost we might feel, is the place where we need to be to learn our next lesson. Spiritual growth cannot be rushed for anyone. When we have learned all there is to learn about a given situation, then we will move on to learn something new, and we will be in our right place once again. By keeping this optimistic outlook, we see that there is nothing that we can do that will not be forgiven. But we must first learn to forgive ourselves. We need simply to affirm and claim our natural birthright to experience God and keep moving forward.
The secret place of the Most High refers to the individual mind. In the privacy of our minds, we can pray to God on a personal level. We can entertain thoughts and ideas that only we and God are aware of. We need not be in church or anywhere in particular to pray to God. Because our thoughts shape our lives, it is imperative that we guard what we think about. If a person lives a prosperous, healthy, fulfilled life, it is obvious that thoughts of prosperity and health are all that are allowed in the secret place of the Most High.
The golden rule for scientific Christianity says that to do unto others as we would have them do in return to us is only part of the task. It is also necessary that we think of others as we would have them think of us. Again, there's so much importance on what takes place in the mind.
The law of life. As we think and act toward others, so shall they respond to us.
Christ is the Lord of karma. Karma, simply stated, means reaping what you sow. Whenever we begin to pray, we can rise above mistakes of the past. Whenever the Christ, meaning the truth about anything, is raised up in prayer, healing results. Sickness, sin, poverty, and confusion, weakness of character, all disappear under the power of the healing Christ. Christ is nothing less than the direct action of God Himself, the self-knowing Spirit. It overrides all else.
Prayer changes things. It alters our character. We are never the same after we have prayed. We help all of mankind with our prayers. A strategy for living is the Lord's Prayer. The Lord's Prayer is the most important of all Christian documents. This great prayer is a compact formula for the development of the soul. Those who use it regularly with understanding will experience a real change of soul. And the Bible refers to this change as being born again. Millions of people repeat this prayer daily without fully comprehending its inner meaning. A deeper understanding of the great prayer can literally change one's life.
As you continue to explore the teachings of Emmett Fox and find that his philosophies help you, you may notice positive changes happening to your life. This isn't magic, but the result of your own thoughts and prayers. There is no external power making things better. The magic is your own choice to examine and alter the thoughts that cross your mind, and the desire to experience the presence of God.
Throughout his teachings, we are reminded not to become overly intrigued by the study of metaphysics, that is, the study of phenomena which cannot be fully explained or comprehended by the six senses. We must live in the world of the present. Sometimes, we use metaphysics as an escape mechanism and avoid solving the problems that face us in the world in which we live. We should take our growing understanding of the Bible and of God and apply these principles to living joyous, successful lives filled with peace and love.
We are here on earth to learn the truth of being. We are here to become self-governed entities, focal points of divine mind, each expressing God in a new way. That is the object of our existence, and the only way to do this is with more knowledge of God. Some individuals may seem to progress more rapidly than others, but the main body of humanity is always steadily growing in the knowledge of God.
Another way to express our purpose on earth is to think of the world as a school, and the two great lessons are that God is absolutely everywhere and the power of thought. We should not be dependent for happiness or self-respect upon human praise or approval. Our attitude should be, I do my duty and enjoy myself wherever I am. I do my job and pass it along to another. I am going to live forever. In 1,000 years from now, I shall still be alive and active somewhere. Always the best is yet to be. Always the future will be better than the present or the past, because I am ever growing and progressing, and I am an immortal soul. I am the master of my fate. I greet the unknown with a cheer and press forward joyously, exulting in the great adventure. Armed with this philosophy and really understanding its power, you have nothing to fear in life or death, because God is all and God is good. Jesus Christ is easily the most important figure that has ever appeared in the history of mankind. This is true whether you choose to call him God or man, and if man, whether you choose to consider him as the world's greatest prophet and teacher, or merely as a well-intentioned fanatic who came to grief and failure and ruin after a short and stormy public career. However you regard him, the fact will remain that the life and death of Jesus and the teachings attributed to him have influenced the course of human history more than any other man who ever lived, more than Alexander or Caesar, Charlemagne, Napoleon, or Washington. More people's lives are influenced by his doctrines, more books are written and read and bought, more speeches or sermons are made concerning him than all the other names mentioned put together. Jesus has been the religious inspiration of the whole European race throughout the ages, the race that has dominated and molded the destinies of the entire world, culturally and socially as well as politically. This alone entitles him to his premier position in world importance. Therefore, there can hardly be a more important undertaking than to inquire into the question of what Jesus really did stand for.
So what did Jesus teach us? What did he really wish us to believe and to do? What were the objectives that he really had at heart? And how far did he actually succeed in accomplishing these objectives in his life and in his death? How far has the religion or movement called Christianity really expressed or represented his ideas? How far does the Christianity of today present his message to the world? If he came back now, what would he say of the self-styled Christian nations in general, and of the Christian churches in particular? Of the Anglicans, the Baptists, the Catholics, the Greek Orthodox, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, the Quakers, the Salvationists, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Unitarians, and so on? What did Jesus teach?
This is the question that Emmett Fox proceeds to answer in his book, The Sermon on the Mount. He proposes to show that the message Jesus brought has a unique value because it is the truth, and the perfect statement of the truth of the nature of God and of man, of life and the world, and of the relationships which exist between them. And far more than this, we find that his teaching is not a mere abstract account of the universe, which would be of little more than academic interest, but that it constitutes a practical method for the development of the soul, and for the shaping of our lives and destinies into the things that we really wish them to be.
Jesus explains to us what the nature of God is, and what our own nature is, tells us the meaning of life and of death, shows us why we make mistakes, why we yield to temptation, why we become sick, impoverished, and old, and how we may bring health, happiness, and true prosperity into our lives and into the lives of others.
The first thing that we have to realize is a fact of fundamental importance, because it means breaking away from all the ordinary prepossessions of Orthodox religion. The plain fact is that Jesus taught no theology whatsoever. His teaching is entirely spiritual or metaphysical. Historical Christianity, unfortunately, has largely concerned itself with theological or doctrinal questions which, strange to say, have no part whatsoever in the gospel teaching. It is startling to learn that all the doctrines and theologies of the churches are human inventions, built up by their authors out of their own mentalities and claimed upon the Bible from the outside. There is absolutely no system of theology or doctrine to be found in the Bible. It simply is not there. People who feel the need of some intellectual explanation of life, and also believe that the Bible is a revelation of God to man, draw the natural conclusion that the one must be within the other, and then proceeded to manufacture the thing that they wish to find. They haven't learned the spiritual or metaphysical key. They aren't operating from the spiritual basis, and consequently they seek a purely intellectual explanation of life. And there can be no such explanation.
The actual explanation of a man's life lies in the fact that we are essentially spiritual and eternal, and that this world and the life we know intellectually is only a cross-section of the full truth. And a cross-section of anything can never furnish even a partial explanation of the whole. Glimpsing one tiny corner of the universe with only half-opened eyes, men built up absurd fables about a limited and a man-like God who conducted his universe much as a rather ignorant and barbarous prince might conduct the affairs of a small kingdom. All sorts of human weaknesses, such as vanity, fickleness, and spite, were attributed to this being. Then, far-fetched and inconsistent legends were built up concerning original sin, infinite punishment for finite transgressions, and the horrible doctrine of predestination to eternal torment. And then, much later, eternal bliss was added. Now, no such theory is taught in the Bible. If it were the object of the Bible to teach it, it would be clearly stated in a straightforward manner in some chapter or other, but it isn't.
The plan of salvation, which figured so prominently in the evangelical sermons and divinity books of a past generation, is as completely unknown to the Bible as it is to the Quran, the Muslim doctrine of faith. There never was any such arrangement in the universe. Therefore, the Bible doesn't teach it at all. What has happened is that certain obscure texts from Genesis, a few phrases taken here and there from Paul's letters, and one or two isolated verses from other parts of the scriptures, have been taken out and pieced together to produce the kind of teaching that seemed proper to be found in the Bible. Jesus says none of this. He is anything but a Pollyanna, as they say, or chief optimist. He warns us, not once but often, that obstinacy in sin can bring very severe consequences, and that man who parts with the integrity of his soul, even though he gains the whole world, is a tragic fool. But he teaches that we are only punished for and actually punished by our own mistakes, and he teaches that every man and woman, no matter how steeped in evil, always has a direct access to an all-living, all-powerful Father God, who will forgive us and supply his own strength to us and enable us to find ourselves again and again.
Jesus has been sadly misunderstood and misrepresented in other directions. For instance, there is nothing whatever in his teachings for the setting up of any form of any hierarchy of officials or system of ritual. He never proposed any such methods. In fact, the whole tone of his mentality is definitely anti-ecclesiastical. Through his public life, Jesus was at war with the churchgoers and religious officials of his own country. They first hindered, then persecuted him, and with a perfectly sound instinct of self-preservation, they felt that the truth, as he taught it, was the beginning of the end for them. And they finally had him put to death.
It seems that human nature is very prone to believe what it wants to believe, rather than reading the scriptures with an open mind. Perfectly sincere men have appointed themselves Christian leaders with the most imposing and pretentious titles, and then clothe themselves in elaborate and gorgeous vestments to impress people, in spite of the fact that their master, in the plainest language, strictly charged his followers that they must do nothing of the kind. According to Matthew, chapter 23, verse 8, "But be ye not called rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ, and all ye are brethren." And he denounced the Pharisees as hypocrites, because they love the chief seats and bind heavy burdens grievous to be borne, signifying their rules and regulations. Jesus made a special point of discouraging any emphasis on outer observances or upon hard and fast rules and regulations of any kind. What he taught was a certain spirit in one's conduct and attitude, and he was careful to teach principles only, knowing that when spirit is right, details will take care of themselves. And in fact, the letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life. Yet in spite of this, the history of Orthodox Christianity is largely made up of attempts to enforce all sorts of external observances on the people. The Puritans attempted to enforce the Old Testament Sabbath, which was a Hebrew ordinance applied exclusively to the desecration of Saturday. Jesus particularly discouraged any Sabbath observance, saying that the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath, and made a point of doing anything he wanted on that day. He clearly indicates throughout his teaching that the time has come when man must make each and every day a spiritual Sabbath by knowing and doing all things in a spiritual light.
There are Christians who do realize that there is no system of theology in the Bible, unless one likes to put it there deliberately, and have practically given up religion altogether, but still cling to Christianity because they feel intuitively that it is the truth. There is really no logical justification for their attitude, since they don't possess the spiritual key which makes the teachings of Jesus intelligible. It's most confusing to those who have neither the blind faith of orthodoxy nor the spiritual interpretation of scientific Christianity to support them.
It's easy to be enthralled by the beauty and mystery of the Gospels, but in the absence of the spiritual key, common sense and all the scientific knowledge of mankind challenges what these Gospels contain. Miracles are a good example. But if the miracles didn't really happen, then does the rest of the gospel story lose all real significance? Jesus believed miracles to be possible and performed them, as he believed and taught many things in contradiction to rational philosophy. He had no interest in superstitious beliefs, because what really interested him was character. Character includes both an intelligence and vital reaction to life. Character must include some definite beliefs and convictions concerning things that really matter. Jesus himself justified what people thought to be a strange and wonderful teaching by the works he was able to do, and he went further and said, referring to those who study and practice his teachings, "The works that I do, ye shall do, and greater works."
The works that I do, ye shall do, and greater works.
Now what, after all, is a miracle? Those who deny the possibility of miracles on the grounds that the universe is a perfect system of law and order, and to the operation of which there can be no exceptions, are perfectly correct. But the explanation is that the world of which we are normally aware, and with whose worldly laws alone most of us are acquainted, is only a fragment of the whole universe, as it really is. And there is no such thing as appealing from a lower to a higher law, from a lesser to a greater expression. For all things are possible in the consciousness of an unlimited universe. So in the sense that all the ordinary rules and limitations of the physical plane can be set aside or overridden by an understanding of the nature of God, then miracles, in the colloquial sense of the word, can and do happen. Let us suppose, for the sake of example, that on a certain Monday your affairs are in such a condition that, humanly speaking, unpleasant consequences are sure to follow by the end of that week. This could even be a lawsuit or a medical diagnosis of a very serious nature. If you can raise your consciousness above the limitations of the physical plane in connection with this matter, the lawsuit or the health problem can melt away.
To raise our consciousness above the limitations of the physical plane is the scientific description of what is commonly called prayer. If we pray successfully, then the condition on that plane will change, and in some utterly unforeseen and normally impossible manner, the problems in our lives melt away to the advantage of all concerned. In other words, miracles, in the popular sense of the word, can and do happen as the result of prayer. Prayer does change things. Prayer does cause things to happen differently than they would have happened had the prayer not been made. It makes no difference at all what sort of difficulty we are in. It doesn't matter what the causes may have been that led up to it. Enough prayer will get us out of our difficulty if we are only persistent enough in raising our consciousness to a high level. Another way to think of it is to raise your awareness level so that you see the world as perfect, see life without the problem. Prayer is both a science and an art. And it was to the teaching of this science and art that Jesus devoted the greater part of his ministry. The gospel miracles happened because Jesus had the spiritual understanding that gave him the greatest power in prayer.
It is the spiritual key that unlocks the mystery of the Bible and of the Gospels in particular. It is the spiritual key that explains the miracles were performed in order to prove to us that we too can perform miracles and overcome sin, sickness, and limitation. With this key, we can afford to discard verbal inspiration and all superstitious literalism, and understand the Bible in its most precious and most authentic interpretation.
Externally, the Bible is a collection of inspired documents written by men of all kinds, in all sorts of circumstances, and over hundreds of years of time. The documents, as we have them, are seldom original, but compilations of older fragments, and the names of the actual writers are seldom known. This, however, doesn't affect the spiritual purpose of the Bible in the slightest degree. It is, in fact, quite immaterial. The book, as we have it, is an inexhaustible reservoir of spiritual truth, compiled under divine inspiration, and the actual route by which it reached its present form doesn't matter. Divine wisdom is the author, and that is all that concerns us. History, biography, lyrical, and other poetic forms are various mediums through which the spiritual message is expressed in the Bible. And above all, the parable is used to convey spiritual and metaphysical truth. In some cases, what was never intended to be more than a parable was taken for literal statement of fact. And this often made the Bible seem to teach things that were opposed to common sense. The story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden is a case in point. Rightly understood, this is perhaps the most wonderful parable of all. Adam represents the physical, and Eve the soul or mind. Together they create the whole being. It was never intended by its author to be taken for history, but literal-minded people did so with all sorts of absurd consequences. The spiritual key to the Bible rescues us from all these difficulties, dilemmas, and seeming inconsistencies. It saves us from the false positions of ritualism and fanaticism because it gives us the truth.
And the truth turns out to be nothing less than the amazing but undeniable fact that the whole outer world, whether it be the physical body, the common things in life, the winds and the rain, or the earth itself, is directly related to man's thought, and that we have dominion over thought when we know it. The outer world, far from being the prison of circumstances that it is commonly supposed to be, has actually no character whatsoever of its own, either good or bad. It has only the character that we give to it by our own thinking. It is naturally plastic to our thoughts, and this is so, whether we know it or not, and whether we wish it or not. All day long, the thoughts that occupy your mind, or your secret place, as Jesus calls it, are molding your destiny for good or evil. In fact, the truth is that the whole of your life's experience is but the outer expression of inner thought. Now, we can choose the sort of thoughts that we think about, and it's difficult to break a habit of bad thoughts, but it can be done. Since we choose how we think, we always do choose, our lives are just the result of the kinds of thoughts we have chosen to hold. They are of our own ordering, and therefore there is a perfect justice in the universe. No suffering for other man's original sin, but the reaping of a harvest that we ourselves have sown. We have free will, but our free will lies in our choice of thought.
Free will lies in our choice of thought.
This is, in essence, what Jesus taught. It is, as we shall see, the underlying message of the whole Bible, but it's not expressed with equal clearness throughout. In the earlier portion of the book, it shines through dimly as the light from a heavily shrouded lamp. But as time goes on, veil after veil is removed, and the light shines ever stronger and stronger, until in the teaching of Jesus Christ, it pours forth clear and unimpeded. Truth never changes, but what we have to deal with on this plane is man's fear of the truth. And throughout historical time, this has been steadily and continuously improving. In fact, what we call progress is merely the outer expression corresponding to mankind's improved awareness of God. Jesus Christ summed up this truth, taught it completely and thoroughly, and above all, demonstrated it in his own person. Most of us can glimpse intellectually the idea of what that must mean in its fullness, and what must inevitably follow from a competent understanding of it. But what we can actually demonstrate or experience in our lives is a very different matter. To accept the truth is the great first step, but not until we have proved it in doing it is it ours. Jesus proved everything that he taught, even overcoming death, in what we call the resurrection. Every time you overcome a difficulty by prayer, you help the whole of the human race, past, present, and future, in a general way. And you help it to overcome that special kind of difficulty in particular. Jesus, by surmounting every sort of limitation to which mankind is subject, in particular by overcoming death, performed a work of unique and immeasurable value for us all forever, and is therefore justly entitled the Savior of the world.
At what he deemed an opportune moment in his public ministry, Jesus decided to sum up his whole teaching in a series of lectures, extending probably over several days and speaking probably two or three times a day. He took this opportunity to summarize the message, to dot the I's and cross the T's, so to speak. A number of those present naturally took notes, and later on these notes were edited into what we know as the Sermon on the Mount. The authors of the four Gospels each selected the material in accordance with their own purpose. And it is Matthew who gives us the most complete and carefully arranged version of this address. It covers all the essentials. It is practical and personal. It is definite, specific, and widely illuminating. Once the true meaning of the instructions has been grasped, it is then only necessary to put them faithfully into practice in order to get immediate results. The magnitude and extent of these results will depend solely upon the sincerity and thoroughness with which they are applied. This is a matter which each individual has to settle for himself. No man can save his brother's soul or pay his brother's debt. We can and should help one another on special occasions, but in the long run, each must learn to do his own work.
If you really do wish to alter your life, if you really do wish to change yourself, to become a different person altogether in the sight of God and man, if you really do want health and peace of mind and spiritual development, then Jesus, in his Sermon on the Mount, has clearly shown you how it can be done. The task is not an easy one, but we know it can be accomplished because there are those who have done it. But there is a price to pay, and the price is the actual carrying out or demonstration of these principles in every corner of your life and in every daily transaction, whether you wish to or not, and especially where you would much rather not. If you are prepared to pay that price, to break really and truly with the old self and start upon the creation of the new self, then the study of the Great Sermon will indeed be your mountain of liberation.
This concludes Side 2, The Golden Keys to Successful Living. Thank you for listening. Thank you.